This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is made possible with support from Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the world's best stock media service offering video, audio, and images with the most affordable subscription plans on the market. Their ever-growing library is over 1 million high-quality, royalty-free assets, so you can bring your content to life more quickly and efficiently than ever before. With Storyblocks' unlimited all-access plan, you get unlimited downloads of everything in the library so you can try out multiple options and find the perfect fit for whatever you're making. Learn more and subscribe today at storyblocks.com/onlyatest. Again, that's storyblocks.com/onlyatest.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, September 24th, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Well, that ended abruptly. Not bad. Not bad. Thank you, Rafi, for making that intro music for us. I get a sense that that one might not have been made with us in mind. It could have just been something they had already pre-made and then submitted. But we'll take it.
What, you're making accusations now?
Well, in the past, other composers have incorporated This Is Only a Test, some type of theme. This one, while synthy, didn't feel like it was catered specifically to us, but who knows?
Norm likes his name written on his birthday cake.
Misspelled is okay, as long as there's some acknowledgement on the receipt that it was made for me and not a generic cake. That's what I want. That's what I want. Thank you, Jeremy Williams and Kishore Hari. Welcome, you guys. We have a full crew this week. How you guys doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm headgeared.
Yeah,
I have so much headgear going on, multi layers of reality affixed on my head. But we'll talk about that. We'll talk. Kishore, we missed you last week. Did you miss our conversation, our breakdown of the Facebook Connect announcements?
I listened to part of it, though. I have to admit, I think the thing I actually tuned into the most was your Quest 2 review. And my IPD does not fall into the areas that's most suited around. I'm like about like one or two kind of points away. So I've been skeptical about getting the Quest 2 because I wonder how it's going to look and feel.
What is your IPD?
I think it's like 67 and a half. I want to say maybe I remember looking and it being like two away from the numbers that Norm mentioned in the video.
68 is the high end. So if you're 67, that's probably better than being at 69 or 70. And I don't think you have a 70 IPD, although I think you're absolutely right. Many of the comments and a lot of the people who've been responding and posting on the social media threads, you know, are outside of that. And this is a smaller range than was previously available on other headsets or even Oculus headsets when they had independent screens moving left and right. And things that were revealed and you know, I can confirm, like when you move it to 68, you do get a little bit smaller field of view as well. So it's going to be tough. It's been one of those things where I could see some people returning theirs if it's not comfortable because, you know, the way they designed it doesn't accommodate everyone perfectly.
You know, one quick question I had, do you have prescription lenses in your Quest?
Mm-hmm, I do.
Do you have any concerns about how that's going to work inside of Quest 2 in the context of not having full PD control?
No, absolutely not. Because the lenses themselves do still shift. And so for me, it's close enough, the sweet spot to my eyes. The prescription lenses are always recommended. Super, super highly recommended. So much more comfortable for that design than trying to squeeze at least like my style of glasses inside a headset, even with the spacer. The thing I'm looking forward to though is the new facial interface. There's one from VR Cover that's supposed to have some, you know, some vents for air and also a better nose cover or optional nose cover. So you can create a better seal. But also Oculus has the wide interface and narrow the fit kit. And I pre-ordered that also because I would still like a better fit around my specific face shape. Yeah. But I want to start off this week with a documentary, because it's something that we all watch. I painted you guys about it last night, and I think it's worth talking about. It's kind of related to the stuff that we talked about last week, and of course with Oculus and Facebook. But there's a new documentary on Netflix right now called The Social Dilemma. And it's about the effects of social media and kind of a lot of the things that we as people who follow technology are at least aware of in terms of how social media monetizes and how they track users and the data profiles they are gathering about users for advertisers. But it was a very interesting documentary in that they had interviews with a lot of executives, a lot of engineers at companies formerly Google, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, but also they did a dramatization. It was intercut, these interviews, with this portrayal of a typical American family with parents and kids of all different ages in school who use social media. What did you guys think about it?
I thought that the documentary, well, not the documentary, the dramatization part that it was interspliced was a really risky thing to do, because that had a lot of risk to go cheesy and to be, you know, something that, you know, people couldn't relate to, especially if they were to take the angle of saying that, you know, Facebook only tries to convert people who are, you know, ignorant or like on the far right or left. And so they did this interesting thing where they said in the dramatization, what one of the family members gets coerced by is far center, right? So it kind of applied to everybody. And I thought that was
extreme center.
Exactly. I thought that was a nice compromise or a way not to like shut people off immediately. But overall, I thought the documentary is required viewing. Like, absolutely, whether take this like dramatization that they intersplice or leave it, what the message of this documentary has to say is, I think, absolutely below the radar for the vast majority of people, despite the fact that there was a lot of press about how Facebook and Cambridge Analytica were able to influence the election 4 years ago and elsewhere in the world. Like it is now just a part of the fabric of social media now that it can influence people. And one of my favorite points about that the documentary makes is that we've heard this phrase constantly about how if you aren't buying something, you are the product, right? We've heard this countless times, right. But this documentary, I think one of the most brilliant things it does is it says that, but then one of the people they interview takes it a step further and says that's too simple. That simplifies it too much. What it is it's, you are not necessarily the product, but changing your mindset is the product. It's just slightly influencing the way that you think and who you are is the product. So it's actually not, you know, always within you, within your power to, you know, retain your morals, your whatever, who you think you are when you're being advertised to. Like, that's the point of advertising, is to affect you. And that is a hard thing to swallow.
Right. And that was Jaron Lanier, the quote unquote father of virtual reality. He makes that fantastic point that takes the kind of what we have been reading on in the technology news an extra step, right? Like I think we understand that we are being advertised to, and advertising and the economics of these business models drive these free services. But it's the way you phrase it specifically, the kind of subconscious and slow and this imperceptible change in behavior, that is something that it's this kind of this coercion that we are completely vulnerable to. And the documentary doesn't pass judgment, right? It doesn't pass judgment on the user. It's not saying that it's because we're dumb. It's because we're human. It's because our brains cannot cope with the magnitude of the algorithms and the computation and on the other side of the screens that we can't fathom. You know, 100,000 years of evolution can't match what Moore's law has done for computing.
Yeah. They have a great illustration of Moore's law too, where they show the graph going up and then what is the highest that you could possibly imagine becomes almost negligible. And again, and again, and again, they really have a great illustration of how technology has evolved, whereas the human brain has not.
So I like this as well. Though, and I agree with Jeremy's assertion that for the vast majority of people, I think there's be surprising information. But I didn't leave like being like, oh my goodness, I had no idea. It was not like that experience for me. Like, I think we've been living in a world that has been talking about the impact of social networks on us for a number of years. So I wasn't surprised about this. And in fact, just like a week or two ago, I actually instituted some like control measures of how often I use social media on my phone and on my browser, because I was noticing an uptick in like kind of like mean-spirited interactions on various platforms, and how that was really leading to some just like unhealthy dispositions in myself at home. So maybe I was already just in that mind state of being like, I need to think of this more as a tool. I think the place that it falls down, like the dramatization didn't kind of work for me, but whatever, you know, that's just, that's
Black Mirror light. Thing.
I think there was a impression that all of this is so new and different. And while the scale of this, the accessibility of this, the fact that everyone has a phone, that everyone is bombarded with these things might be different, I didn't think there was enough acknowledgement of how this sort of manipulation has been going on for a long time. Like seeing the, like when I was a kid, it was at the grocery checkout stands looking at like the National Enquirer and all those tabloids and how they would kind of seed certain things. There's always been like people that try to sort of get this rise, like we call them trolls now, but they existed in the past. And I think there needs to be some acknowledgement that there isn't necessarily some new interfaces being created, but just sort of an expansion upon already existing items that have been in play.
There was
stuff that oh yeah, go ahead.
There was that one moment in the panel discussion where the older guy, you know, basically makes that argument, which is like, this is nothing new and we will persevere. Yeah. We will figure our way through this. But the you know, the younger gentleman who worked, you know, I think it was at Google, he said, you know, this is actually something new. The thing that's new here is the AIs that are behind it that are providing everybody with their own tailored experience. Like,
yeah,
magazines can't
do scale. I fully acknowledge that. The stuff that always gets me with these conversations is all the radicalization stuff. And that's something that we're in the throes of. Not to sound like every internet bro out there, but did you listen to the Reply All last week where they were talking about 8chan and, and 4chan and like the just the connection to Q and all of these things? Like, it is there is like a whole portion of this ecosystem, AI influenced or not, that is just wildly invisible to my experience.
Right.
And that radicalization, which isn't just, you know, every platform, it looks different. That stuff scares the crap out of me in a really tangible way, because we have like real legitimate moments in our culture and in recent times where that's led to some dramatic consequences.
Yeah, and in some ways, this reminds me a lot of watching An Inconvenient Truth, decades ago, in terms of like it being this warning sign. And the big difference is, of course, Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore ended that with some optimism. And unfortunately, you know, we have not moved down that path. And this is where I think the documentary kind of abruptly ended. And yes, they acknowledge, you know, social media isn't inherently bad, and there are some benefits to the connection that we have and the miracles of the magic of technology today and how our lives have improved with all this. But the prescriptions that they provide were kind of the common sense prescription, like things you talk about, Kishore, of just sending personal boundaries and guidelines. And this did feel like a documentary made for parents. Like, I'm sure a teenager watching this, a college student watching this, it's probably going to roll their eyes or not feel like it's impactful for them. But I think watching it as a parent, as someone who is thinking down the line of what this means for, you know, for a kid and giving them access to social media, like this felt a little more resonant to me.
Yeah. I wonder for what age though, because some of the content is pretty complicated and requires, you know, a bit of a wide worldview in order to appreciate it. And also maybe some perspective on how it used to be before social media. So I don't know what age group would really be able to digest it. Like, I don't think my 10-year-old would get it. Like, I just think that,
oh, you know, I don't think it's for them to watch. I think it's for parents of those age groups to right. watch, especially the ones who, in our generation, are, you know, some of the last folks who knew what I was like before this curve.
Yeah, yeah. And that's certainly the sort of the thrust of the narrative, of the dramatization, as, you know, the parents at one point, they decide to lock the phones away during dinner. That causes an argument, leads to a broken phone, and one of the kids then has the challenge to leave the phone alone for a week, and of course can't do it.
Why would you leave that phone plugged in and not powered off during that challenge?
Yeah.
Like, there's just some bad scripting and story writing. Those parents were bad parents. Like, they weren't connecting with their kids in a way to help them. Like, they weren't having good conversations with their kids. They weren't engaging them, taking them on, like, you know, the opposite of the social media addiction is like real human connection, and the parents are in the best possible place to create, to connect with those kids. But like, even at that dinner table and that one scene they had, they were failing at that.
Yeah, it definitely was like a riff tractable dramatization. Like, yeah. you could totally see that. But yeah, I do think I agree with you. It is definitely something for parents to be aware of, especially, like, you know, I still like to think of myself as being tech savvy, but I did not grow up with this. And so, and my kids are. And so I certainly don't know what it's like to have to be a preteen and have so much riding on my social media likes and dislikes, or the comments that I might get on Instagram. My kids, thankfully, are still not on Instagram or on social media. But it's around the corner. It's a matter of, you know, a couple of years at the max.
Yeah. It's called The Social Dilemma. It's on Netflix, and I guess Netflix can get away with, you know, running this and making this and producing this because they don't sell ads. They and Apple are in a different business model of just taking your money directly. It's not that they don't buy ads on those very maybe same networks, but they definitely, there's no mirror held to them. Amazon, I don't think, could get away with running this documentary.
For example. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Apple was not a focus of this at all. I don't even know if they were mentioned, except for in the end, there's a clip of Steve Jobs talking about, you know, how he thinks of the computer as a mental bicycle. Sure. But you're right. I mean, that's where, and that's been a part of their narrative for years now, is that they are not in the business of selling ads, they're in the business of selling you stuff.
Hey, I guess if all the predictions that they say hold true, and it is scary, right? When the guy at the end's like, you know, what do you think is the short-term, you know, consequence of this? And he's like, civil war. And we're all like, well, you know, looking at what's going on in the world right now, that feels like it could be around the corner. You know, the breakdown of societies, democracies. But, you know, along with those comes the breakdown of the economics models, right? And then they are less incentivized to run businesses like this.
I do think that was one of the biggest points of the film, which is that if you look at the, you know, political division right now, which is, like, you know, just off the chart, and you have to think to yourself, how can these people on the other side think that way if they're seeing the same news that I am? And they're not seeing the same news that you are. Like, that's the point. And it's being driven, you know, not only by social media, also by, you know, cable news networks. But that's follow the money. Like, it's because that's how you get people to spend more time on your platform, is by feeding them information that algorithmically has been found to, you know, drive clicks and time spent. Yeah. So yeah, what is the solution? What are we going to do? Are we going to take our phones away for a week? I mean, there was no clear solution given in this documentary. That's one of the starkest things about it.
All right, Jeremy, I'll be by later. We'll put your phone in a bag, and I'll be back a week later.
Hey, if that solves the problem, I'm in.
The cookie jar. I mean, it especially is relevant today, where we cannot leave our homes, where most people, you know, are discouraged from leaving their homes because of the worldwide pandemic. Like, in the past, getting fresh air, going outdoors, playing sports, you know, taking a walk. These were the things that I would do to get away from social media, but it is way too easy. And you know, we acknowledge that, you know, being online in this way is too easy. And the kind of some of the ways that we find a relief from what's happening in the world right now. And some, for some people who live by themselves or, you know, don't have families, they're not going to find those outlets. And so I think we definitely see it from a different perspective, being older, being more mature, having the same different kinds of, you know, needs and having gone through all the emotional roller coasters of being a young person. I definitely felt old watching this. And hey, shout out to Pete Campbell from Mad Men for getting triple roles in this. I don't know if you guys watch Mad Men, but Pete Campbell from Mad Men plays the AI ad robots in this, and good for him. All right, let's move on to our actual top tech story this week.
Top story this week.
You know, as I was watching that documentary, one of the things I was thinking about, we didn't grow up with the kind of social media that the kids grew up today, but one of the types of social media that we did grow up with was video games. You know, video games, online gaming was a way we connected with people. And it, for many people, that is still, you know, their friends groups outside of the Facebooks and Instagrams of the world. And we got new consoles coming out this holiday season. Either of you get in on the PS5 or the Xbox Series X pre-sales?
I can't buy shit on no PS5, no Xbox, no RTX 3080. I've just resigned that like anytime a company announces a device, I might be able to get it in 12 months. Sorry, I'm going to go on like a massive rant. I just think the bot scalping, there isn't being enough done, and there's no incentive for the companies to actually change it. And I think what's happening on eBay is just like a travesty unto the experience for so many.
Yeah, no, I didn't get one either. And I was kind of thinking I might pick up a 3080 this year and a PlayStation 5, but I wasn't tracking the launch, and I didn't know anything about them. And by the time that I found out about them, like it was, you know, an hour had passed, and I felt like the sloth in Zootopia. You know, went.
The sloth in Zootopia also drove a really fast car.
Yeah.
So that's your 3080 right there, right? You're the sloth with all the flops.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, I suppose I could have picked up an Xbox because I happened to be there when that launched, but I don't want that. No. So I picked up a Quest 2, and honestly, of like all the stuff, that's the thing I want the most. I realize I'm in the minority, but hey, that's good for me.
Hey, you also have an HP Reverb pre-ordered, so you know, I'm looking forward to that as well.
Yep.
G2. It's one of those situations where I really wish there was, in the way Twitch does it and the way YouTube live chat does it, a way to archive the flow of conversation of tweets and posts on social media when these things happen. Because while I did not partake necessarily in the pre-orders for the Xbox Series X, and I tried for the PS5, following the people that I followed and watching those tweets pop up in real time with the frustrations, that is an ephemeral time capsule of, you know, what it's like, consumer culture, gaming culture, internet culture in this month, 2020, that I wish we could look back on. Because it made me think back to the launches of previous consoles and the pre-order systems. Obviously, back then it was different. We waited in line outside of Targets and Toys R Us's for the PSPs and the Nintendo Wii's. But, you know, things are shifting, and of course it's different this year. But yeah, what a cluster F, what a, you know, of...
This is your worst journalist take ever, Norm. Like, you're like, I wish we could encapsulate all the hate and rage of the
historical
frustration over this.
It's like the anthropological look at internet culture, because I'm not gonna wade in there because of the mess it was, and looking at Microsoft sniping at Sony for how botched their pre-sale launch was, and then failing to meet demand and having their site crash for the launch. Oh my God, what hubris! Well, that hubris also allows them to spend to the tune of $8 billion to buy Bethesda.
Oh, it's only $7.5 billion.
$7.8 billion, closer to the eight, but nearly eight Instagrams were spent to buy Bethesda and the IP they own, which also includes, you know, id Software, Doom, Quake, and now under the Microsoft umbrella.
The purchases of ZeniMax, which owns Bethesda and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. So Prey.
Not just Doom and Quake, like you got Skyrim in there.
Fallout.
Fallout. Yeah. I mean, these are massive franchises.
Prey, Dishonored.
They are massive franchises. And even if you look at them individually, you can say, you know, there's obviously a lot of strong audience and legacy for Doom and Fallout, of course, despite some, you know, the missteps of the last launch at 76. But it's to bolster the Series X launch and to bolster their subscription plan. And they really want to bundle this in to their Game Pass, which is really strong with that deal with EA. I'm not surprised that ZeniMax wanted to sell because, you know, the AAA games business is risky. It's like the movie business where they can spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a game like Fallout 76 and then the critical reception not being where they want to be. It's pretty cutthroat.
I loved seeing Mike Micah's tweet after this news hit, which was, hey Microsoft, after the honeymoon, we want to talk to you about Commander Keen. It's like the perfect digital eclipse title. You know, the remake, this is id's game that they made that was like their huge smash hit before Wolfenstein, right? So it's kind of a small scale hit.
That I'm so disappointed that, you know, go back to that Netflix documentary that we talked about, where they did the history of games, of console games, you know, from Atari to essentially the early PC games era. And they did a whole interview with John Romero, and he wonderfully told this tale about the early days of id pre-Wolfenstein and what it was for John Carmack overnight to try to replicate the smoothness of side scrolling on a PC, which Mario had, but they did not have on PC games at the time. And yet he never once did they acknowledge the game was Commander Keen.
Right.
That was at one point said Commander Keen. I was like, say the name. What a milestone for PC gaming.
I had to make Mario, but Nintendo passed on it.
Yeah.
Can we talk about what this does for Game Pass? Like, isn't Game Pass all of a sudden, which was always kind of a good value in comparison to the other offerings, was always a better product. But like the limitation has always been about the launch titles, like the exclusives comparatively to like PS5. But now Game Pass comes with what I'm assuming is going to come with all of this stuff. Is under this umbrella, which all of a sudden makes like Xbox much more attractive. Like I was completely out on the Xbox because I want to play. I want to be Miles Morales. I want to play like the exclusive, like I want to be in that PlayStation ecosystem because of the games. But this is the first time I've had pause about getting back into the Xbox ecosystem. Probably going back to like 360.
I don't follow the Xbox at all. I had a 360. Didn't have the last generation, current generation. But I have friends that do, and a friend of mine who's you know in the industry pretty you know and loves the Xbox. He was saying before this that the Game Pass was an insane deal, like too good of a deal in terms of like being good for developers. Like it may not be good for developers kind of level deal because there's so much content, you're paying so little. It's almost like you could equate it to Apple Arcade where you're paying, you know, $5 a month for 100 games. How could those developers possibly be making a good return on it unless it's simply just funded by Apple? So this is kind of the same thing where it's like, yeah, but at what point does it stop making sense for Microsoft in order to fund this level of commitment to Game Pass? It's kind of an insane deal. But, you know, I guess you could argue good for consumers.
And, you know, now that they own that company, they own those games, they don't need to make the incremental costs. Their incremental cost is the Game Pass, right? And they see in the long run, the fact that, you know, a consumer can look at it and say, it looks like too good of a deal. They love that. They love that because they'll get your credit card and then they'll get that money back from you one way or another. And then
is it sustainable? Like, that's what I wonder.
Oh, I guess, yeah. subscriptions are proven to be sustainable. I mean, you look at, I always go back to the example of like Spotify as one of the first successful modern subscription services, and obviously Apple, Apple Music and all that stuff now. But like, you look at your credit card history and like how much I've paid over time for those subscriptions and like HBO. And if you try to break that down to like how many movies or CDs I would have bought, I never would have spent that much money. They got my money. Right. You know, this talk about the social dilemma, where I'm waiting for that Netflix documentary, The Subscription Dilemma, coming 2 years from now. Maybe from Apple.
And the hardware is just expensive enough to feel obligated to stay in that that subscription ecosystem.
Yeah.
The two questions that come up for me are we going to see more acquisitions? I know Microsoft is unique in like how much money it has to throw around here. And I'm not suggesting Microsoft is going to buy more things, but is this going to spur other acquisitions? And then, like, I have a weird, this is less of a question, more of a take. Like, I have a weird take on this. Like, you know who I think the real loser is out of this? I know everyone's talking about, like, you know, how this impacts Nintendo and PlayStation. I think they're fine. I think Apple Arcade is the real loser here. Honestly, and the reason is like, not like it, you can criticize Google for their Stadia thing. Neither of them, who put so much money in this space, really invested in the AAA IP. And now we're seeing what that's going to do to them. They're getting crushed by this. I know, totally different platform, totally different, you know, potential user base, blah, blah, blah. Like, when I look at Game Pass in the context of Apple Arcade as game subscription services, like, forget it. Like, well, not even the same conversation.
It's why they won't allow Xbox to do Game Pass on iOS and streaming on iOS unless they go through the hoops of, you know, having every game be submitted and available by, so they can get their cut, because, you know, it's a place where they are not strong.
I don't know if Apple Arcade was a success to begin with. You know, I mean, there was press a couple months ago about how they were completely revamping their approach to games. They wanted games that were stickier, and like one of the games that they used as an example was, you know, one of these like Match 3 games that, you know, it wasn't a Bethesda game. It's completely different. You know, I love that Apple enabled compatibility with Xbox and PlayStation gamepads. That's great, but they'll never be a game platform like in the same sense, because that's not what they do best.
But now they're fighting their subscription company. That's what the Apple One bundle with multiple pricing points within Apple One. There's multiple Apple Ones. That's who they are now as a company. So guess what Xbox and PlayStation are? They're subscription companies now too. So, like, I would say they're more of a competitor now to those places than they were a year or two ago.
I mean, to go back to the early point in the social dilemma of like what these companies are trying to do, they're trying to get your screen time, right? The same with the game consoles. It might not be for advertisers, but what they want to do is, when you have that TV in your house and you're on the couch, because that is something that people do, sit in their living rooms on their couch, eat dinner, you know, they want you to spend that time playing a game versus watching Netflix versus browsing the web. And that doesn't work when you're, you know, traveling and you have your phone. So what the Apple Arcade is competing against is for the time that people are using on their phones. And those games, while they can be, it's why the Match 3 games work, because they work on that same dopamine trigger that the slot machines work on, which is with the same triggers that the social media networks work on. And that's what people are going to gravitate toward on those devices. It's all dystopian. No good news this week. Hey, one piece of good news. John Carmack tweeted in response to Microsoft buying ZeniMax and said, to quote, "Great. I think Microsoft has been a good parent company for gaming IPs, and they don't hold a grudge against me. So maybe I will be able to re-engage with some of my old titles."
Commander Keen, VR, you heard it first.
I think we're all thinking maybe a different one, but you know, we were watching the Facebook Connect keynote, and I think I tweeted you, like, when Zuckerberg did his playing Echo VR with Boz. I was like, this is the Bill Gates playing Doom and Windows 95 moment for Zuck. And, you know, just days later, Microsoft bought Doom. So wait, is there coming full circle.
Is there a video of Bill Gates playing Doom?
Wait, you don't know about this?
I don't remember that. No, this, I have to look
when
that
they
up.
Promoted, I tweeted it. You can Google Bill Gates Doom. But when he was doing, maybe it was a CES keynote, but it's definitely a video recorded of him promoting Windows 95. One of the big things with Windows 95 was all the graphics. And so they did this whole thing where he's like, hey, you can play games like Doom. And then they did like a mixed reality thing where he's like holding the Doom gun. He's blasting away and it was like the big selling point of Windows 95. All your games are compatible too. Yeah. That's what it made me think of with the Zuck playing Echo VR. And of course now, like I said, Microsoft and Doom. But Doom VR, to come full circle, it was what John Carmack was so excited to show off on that duct tape together Oculus Rift, DK1, way back at, what was it, QuakeCon or E3, E3 2012. And
dude, I don't think that was a DK1. That was like DK0. Yeah. That was the first VR demo, like, you know, from Carmack or Palmer Luckey. Like that was early. And you're right. I'd love to see that come all the way full circle.
Yeah, well, we're going to get Doom 3 hopefully on SideQuest at some point soonish. So, you know, it may happen whether Carmack's involved or not, but it'd be extra cool if John Carmack was involved. All right, we're going to do reverse order for podcasts for the rest of the show this week. So, obviously, we wanted to catch up on all the stuff that happened after we podcasted last week for Facebook Connect. So, let's get to the VR Minute.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality this week.
I'm going to flip down my visor. Uh-oh. Yeah, there it goes. I'm wearing a HoloLens 2.
Augmented reality.
I just want to be clear to our audio listeners, that was not the sound of the device. That was actually Norm's sound effect that he made. I want to be really upfront.
So John Carmack did a live stream toward the end of the Wednesday, 5:30 Wednesday. It's all online, all archived on YouTube, so you can watch the whole thing. It's well worth watching, an hour and a half, very unscripted, just talking through a debrief of like the decisions that went into designing Quest 2 and mobile VR. And it became very clear listening to Mike Abrash's talk and John Carmack's talk that, you know, it's something we kind of knew, but these are very separate teams. That the AR side of Facebook, which is, I think it's bigger than the VR side, is that they are working toward their own pipeline, their own technologies to get to the dream of AR glasses. And while VR, a lot of stuff in terms of the world sensing stuff and SLAM stuff will probably converge on the VR side, that's a very product focused side right now, making the Quest 2, making games and making things that are shippable, which is what John Carmack is fundamentally interested in. Some big takeaways in talking about the hardware, you know, the Qualcomm chip, the XR2, he acknowledged much faster, of course, its latest generation, but is not used to its full capacity in the Quest 2. That they're, because of thermal load, they can only basically get about 50% of the 50% faster than the 835 that they had. While GPU, they can use more, and there are things that, of course, they can tap into in terms of the special processors for imaging, for IO, that, you know, he went to the nitty gritty of like the things they had to change to accommodate, you know, the chromatic aberration tweaks and the compensation in that.
A lot of the tracking using the DSP and the 835. So he said they have a lot more toys to play with now. And we didn't see, obviously, hand tracking launch until well after the launch of the Quest. So that's the kind of thing that they were able to discover and employ. Now they have even more at their disposal. I don't think we've seen the last of what the Quest 2 is capable of.
True, very true. And one of the things that he griped about was just, this is a big team right now. Like there are lots of different teams working under Quest 2. And organizationally, it makes a lot of sense that they're kind of disparate. You know, there's a team working on Guardian. There's a team working on the core UI and a team working on the game stuff and the store. And all of that gets composited together with the compositor, with their shell. And that creates inefficiencies. And that's one of the reasons Quest 2 isn't shipping with 90 hertz native. It's going to be a beta feature because Guardian wasn't ready, because that pass-through only still ran at 72. And there were some incompatibility at 90. So these are kind of like the wonderful little insights. And, you know, he has a product person, has strong opinions about things like ergonomics of controllers and just usability. And so it's really interesting to dive down into, for someone who has a lot of say and makes cases, you know, from a user perspective as well, into what goes into a product, you know, things that he fights for and pushes for a product like Quest 2.
And I think most notably among them is a wireless link that he said he's a proponent of. And he gets pushback. Apparently, there's two sides to that discussion. And he said, I don't know, he implied that they can get quite heated, yeah. That people who believe that a wireless link should and can be, you know, done even better than it's been done so far. And there is clearly a use case for it. There's people out there using virtual desktop to stream off of the computer to the Quest and having an experience that they consider to be perfectly comfortable and usable, preferable in many cases to having a link cable. And yet there's people on the other side of the argument who say, nope, it's not going to be as good as a wired link. There's going to be more latency. The quality is not going to be as crisp. We're not going to do it. And I am 100% on CarMax's side. And so much to say, like when it launched last week, I suggested maybe there's hardware in there to enable it in the future. But yeah. I'm hesitant to think that now. And unfortunately, I don't know if we'll see wireless link.
And he even gave the name AirLink. And I don't think, you know, he's not holding out on that. I think Link itself is something that they want to spend the resourcing to improve, because that will be the way to play the desktop games with Quest 2 with the Rift S going away. They never really fully answered about the Wi-Fi 6. I think, you know, XR2 has Wi-Fi 6 capabilities, not in a sense of whether it actually taps into the full bandwidth. You know, he said it's a 2x2 connection, which is, yes, you're going to get like 300 megabits, but the full potential of Wi-Fi 6 is an order of magnitude above that. And we don't have clarification about whether the radios are in there for that part of the spec. But yeah, definitely really interesting. You know, it's a product that they were very impressed to have turned around so quickly after Quest 1 shipped. And as of right now, you can still pre-order it on places like Amazon and still get it on launch day on October 13th.
Oculus's shipments have been pushed to first week of November, but I guess, yeah, some of the retailers still have them available for launch.
Yeah, and then there are a couple other interviews that are worth watching. MKBHD did a podcast interview, it's on YouTube, with Zuckerberg himself about how he sees these technologies. And so much of it is about the idea of presence for him, of connecting people. You know, it's a lot of just the same kind of PR talk we've seen. Distinguishing, I think, importantly, between how Facebook sees an augmented reality product versus how Google saw like a Google Glass type product. You know, the idea of notifications being popped up on screen was less interesting, it sounded like, from Facebook's perspective, you know, what things that an Apple Watch might do, than the kind of enhancement of senses, which ties into something that Michael Abrash has talked a lot about, which is what AR for him feels like. It's the superpower. It's a thing that can identify what you're looking at and give you, you know, information about it, augment your audio clarity and all these senses that you take for granted, giving you that extra, not just layer of information, but the way you interact with that visually and auditorily.
I mean, this is a superpower already. You know, you want to translate into any language, you're speaking to somebody who doesn't speak your language, you can do it. You know, you can find directions to anywhere, you can look up anything on Wikipedia. To put that in terms of your live real-time senses, that's another layer, man. That's going to be something else.
Yeah, and I think audio, you know, there was that Facebook Reality Labs video that came out about audio sensing and, you know, using focus to be able to pinpoint and hear things better. That's something that is solvable. I think that's why the video is out there, is because the optics problem is still so many unknowns that maybe they're not ready to share yet. But the audio side of it is, they can see that roadmap to making that a valuable killer app for AR. And so I'm glad they've shared that. Other news that came out is that from the sessions is that the Quest is now going to allow, or will soon allow, after launch, Quest 2 will allow the downloading of unlisted apps, not via the in-store menu, but basically through a web link, or you can click, you know, a website, or click it on your phone, and then it will queue up for download on your headset an app that does not need to be approved by their moderation team or their QA team. So it essentially, it bypasses the need for side quest.
And sideloading at all.
And sideloading at all, completely. And there was an interview from the creator of SideQuest about, you know, his thoughts on this. And it's good for developers. And I think Facebook will still take a cut for apps that will charge based on that listing. It just won't be surfaceable for people who just want to browse through the store in headset or the store via the standard Oculus app on their phone. But basically, it kind of takes away from that business. And they're going to integrate, I think, those links into SideQuest and make that more of a curated place for people to find those links. But the ability for SideQuest to be the only place, really, for you to get those APKs easily loaded onto your headset, that's going away. I mean, I think it's good for developers, but I also appreciate what SideQuest has done. I did finally watch that video that you mentioned last week, Jeremy, of Infinite Desktop. This is that Mocha Abrash experimental thing with the track Logitech keyboard. No brainer in my mind. Track input, track keyboard, I think is going to be so much more practical and usable than the virtual keyboard or even virtual cursors using gestures, both because of latency and also precision. But man, I walked away from that being like, no one's going to use their headset. This fantasy video of someone walking around their house, putting on a headset, using pass-through just to, you know, do some collaboration. It seems such like a bootstrap cobbled together demo using existing technologies. I could not imagine a virtual workspace actually functioning like that.
Yeah, I wonder if the resolution is high enough in order to really feel good. But it's certainly, you know, it's what I see that as is just the Quest is a great, cheap prototyping tool for augmented reality. You know, people working on those teams can get started now in developing what those, you know, just experimenting, seeing what those experiences might feel like, what works and what doesn't. And, you know, the dream of not needing monitors and being able to make all your monitors virtual around you and having the slam of the device know where your desk is and remember where things should be. I mean, that's real. And it looks to me like they're already making some headway, and we might even be able to test that out ourselves. You're right. I don't think it's going to actually be a desktop replacement for anybody.
Or the way they portrayed it in terms of hanging on the couch and then, you know, oh no, I want to get away from, you know, the housemates and go to a different place and then pull up the VR interface. It's like there's so much of the user experience in the UI in their demo that felt incomplete. In fact, like the closest I felt to using that kind of virtual collaborative desktop environment was in thing like Big Screen, where like the three of us would be sitting in the virtual theater and we'd each have our desktops in front of us and our own suite of drawing tools in front of us in our near field. And we could see that you were looking at your menus, you were looking at your desktop on the side, and then maybe throw something up on the big projector or the big theater screen. Like that felt like more akin to what a virtual collaborative working environment would be like. I want to give a shout out. Yep, go ahead.
I'm just gonna say, like the augmented reality would put you in my environment, and that's I think that's what people want, and that's why they're employing the black and white pass through, to make that happen, and that's why I mean they need to prototype that experience because that is the one that's gonna be the mass market product someday.
I got a taste of that experience today. And that's why I'm wearing this headset right now, this HoloLens. So the reason I'm wearing a HoloLens 2 is I have this on loan from Spatial, their company that where they did a video presentation. They were part of one of the presentations at Connect last week. But they make a product that's available on Quest now and available on HoloLens and will be on Unreal. It's AR, it's VR, it's also browser-based, it's completely asymmetrical, but it creates a virtual environment where if you're in VR, the three of us could be VR avatars and could be drawing, pulling up web browsers and writing on sticky notes and putting things on a virtual whiteboard. But the AR experience that I got today, I was in that same virtual environment, but it was my living room. And then I had avatars floating around my living room, throwing things up on the wall that I pinned as my anchor wall for sticky notes, for objects, and pulling 3D objects that they had uploaded from their web browser, their computers. And then those objects appeared in my space and I could manipulate them, expand them and shrink them. And it was cool. It felt like exactly like what you're talking about, what I wanted the AR collaboration to feel like, where I could still be on my laptop or on my phone, but then someone could pop in and I could see their virtual avatar and then have a conversation with them and feel like they're in the same room as me.
How does the HoloLens 2 compare to other AR headsets that you've used in terms of field of view?
So it's about 50 degrees and a little taller than it is wide. So much better than the postage stamp, you know, window that was in HoloLens 1. They do a good job. You can see if you're watching the video that, you know, they cover up almost my glasses, but in the same way the Nreal did, there's a lot of like just space underneath the glasses where, because it's beyond where the lenses are, my brain naturally doesn't expect there to be holograms outside of that field of view. So they've kind of hardware framed in. And even within that, they've done software vignetting where objects disappear gracefully, you know, fade away when they're outside. To one where I do have to train my head. It's less of my eyes looking around. There is eye tracking, but it's more my head looking around to place the objects back into its field of view. But the thing I love so far about using HoloLens, no controller, it's the hand tracking. And using the hand tracking, like right now, I see these rays that are cast from my hands, laser pointers essentially, and I can pull them up and I can look at my wrist and tap a start menu button. And I have a menu now popped up right here. Then I can actually poke into and navigate like a start menu. This is what Magic Leap didn't have. Magic Leap had their totem, right? Their three DOF, or no, it was six DOF, the magnetic, but their controller.
It was a hardware controller.
It was a hardware controller and it just wasn't as intuitive. So this combines that hand tracking that I love from using the Quest and using, what was it called? The hand tracking, the IR blaster thing. Remember, what am I thinking of?
The IR
The thing that you put on your desk and you put your hand.
Oh, yeah, not Magic Leap, but Leap Motion.
Leap Motion, right. Leap Motion, the kind of hand presence that Leap Motion and the Quest hand tracking have, that feels like they've brought that into AR. And the gestures of like clicking and, you know, scanning the world, the slam is all really nicely done where they have these geometric forms that kind of wrap around the walls. I can see that it's mapped that plane. It's just really, really nicely integrated.
I love the idea of pressing something on your wrist, because that's what Oculus calls passive haptics, you know, because you still feel something. There's still something tactile there, but you don't need something active to get that feedback.
And this is a fixed focus headset, right? Like there's a sweet spot for where the menus are. It's not varifocal. So where when I press this start menu button on my wrist and it pops up.
We can hear that.
You can hear that. Okay. So it's popped up. It is like right here and it's perfectly crisp. It's like right floating right in front of the camera lens right here. And I can tap the arrow keys and go to all apps. And I can it feels like I'm interacting with this perfectly floating object in front. The opacity is pretty good. I mean, I can see the camera behind, you know, it's the same kind of waveguide artifacts where you see like the rainbow effects and you see kind of interlacing, and but text is crisp. I can read web pages, I can read the UI, and it's, you know, it gives me a lot of hope for AR.
Yeah.
From a consumer standpoint. It still feels like something I'd want to be working and wearing at a desk here and at most in like a living room and not really out in the real world. But I think that's kind of what's accepted by Apple and Facebook and Microsoft. And I think we hear so much about Apple's the rumored plans for their AR glasses, and of course Facebook being very open about pursuing AR as the thing past VR, but Microsoft has a headset in the marketplace right now that works, that people are using, that big companies are using, and their apps like Spatial that take real good use of it, and so they, you know, they're a sleeping giant there.
That's cool.
I'm gonna flip up my glasses now as we exit this.
Well, welcome back, Luke. How was your lightsaber training?
Oh my goodness. I could feel it. I could feel the blaster fire. let's move on then to a moment. Oh my goodness. Where's this? A moment of science.
Now it's time for a moment of science.
So a quick thing before we talk about Tesla Battery Day, which is actually some exciting science for once. We passed a grim milestone in the United States just a couple days ago with 200,000 COVID deaths confirmed by GHU, by Johns Hopkins, and a grim milestone in the context of we're probably significantly undercounting the number of coronavirus deaths in this country. The estimates are upwards of 10 to 15% of an undercount. So it's just another reminder that of what has been sacrificed to get us to this point and how much farther we have to go. There is a lot of vaccine news that is going to inundate all of you. And I have a piece of advice. Try to stay away from it. This is something I said, I think almost 6 months ago, or at least like 4 or 5 months ago. There is going to be a lot of ups and downs with the rollout and distribution of any vaccine, even if it's proven safe and effective. And I think for the wide majority of us, we're not going to, you know, see a product like that for months, if not a year, or longer. And which means that, you know, what's happening now, while might be interesting, is probably going to go through a lot of ups and downs. So I'm actually staying abreast of that topic, but not getting too involved in it, because I know there's still a lot more ups and downs to come as we head towards an approval. All right. Tesla Battery Day. This was the hyped event that was supposed to happen, I think, in early May. And had been pushed back, and Elon got on stage and talked about their entire cost structure. And I want to sort of break down the battery component of this. So typical battery, anode, cathode, and in the context of the batteries that are in Tesla cars, they have tabs that are essentially welded onto the battery context to direct the flow of electricity into the larger system. They indicated that in terms of the manufacturing cost to make those batteries, like something like 55%, maybe 65% are the raw materials. So like 35% is the cost of nickel, 25% is the cost of lithium, which is really the material that the electrons move through, the substrate. And then 5% is the cost of cobalt, which is another rare earth item. But really 35% of the cost is sort of like in processing, and then there's manufacturing costs on top of that. And a big part of the cost is this idea as they build the battery is welding on these tabs onto the battery, because it takes time, there's precision, and that time equates to additional cost and in the overall process. And so what he laid out was this idea that we saw some patents for earlier in this year, which is a tabless battery that's almost like sort of like a jelly rolled up battery. So imagine like a fruit roll up, where there's layers of the battery that sort of rolled together. And within it, there's kind of spiky elements that essentially poke into the next layer. And that sort of poking into the next layer is how the electrons will actually cross in this battery. So as opposed to sort of being the traditional way of, you know, flowing from the anode to the cathode and then out the tab. So there's one exit point for the electricity. There's going to be multiple points for that, for those electrons to flow and then exit the battery. And because of that multi-flow, they can manufacture these a lot faster because they don't have to weld on these tabs and the process goes quicker. Then on top of that, seem to indicate that we can actually start using silicon in these batteries that is cheaper than the graphite embedded silicon that's used conventionally, which I think is, what was the number? I think it was $6 per kilowatt hour. $10 per kilowatt hour for the graphite embedded silicon. And their process is dipping this sort of a less sort of purified silicon in into this conductive goo, which they didn't really talk about. And that coating will allow them to take the cost down from $10 a kilowatt hour to $1.20 per kilowatt hour. All this was very future facing. It's not like they brought out a battery and was like, here we go. Here's the tabless battery and it's ready to go. It all seems like it's 2 to 3 years away. But this improvement in manufacturing processes is what's going to drive down the cost of the Tesla and drive up the availability of it. So this whole idea of changing the process to tabless battery is how they get to a $25,000 Tesla and how they get so many more of them out there. The thing that I'm most skeptical of that they spoke to was this idea of using the lithium that's just embedded in clay, that's just sort of widely available throughout Nevada, and being able to purify that. Did you hear that part of the thing? That was a very strange part of the presentation that I don't sort of buy. And I think there's going to be safety and performance benchmarks. Like from what I read from a number of engineers, the tabless battery as a concept and design totally makes sense. Is it going to have the same the ideal performance that that Elon laid out over an extended period of time? Are there going to be other complications in the manufacturing process at this scale? That are going to cut into those cost savings that he's indicating? Is it going to be as easy as sort of retrofitting elements of the Gigafactory, as he indicated, to drive this forward? I don't know. Yeah, like you have to actually have to have a battery at the end of the day. But the promise is 5 times as much energy in this 4680 battery, which is 46 millimeters by 80 millimeters. Which means like an increased range of almost 20% on your car.
$25,000 car. I mean, I don't think though that's everything regarding price. I think is taken with a huge grain of salt. You know, like the $35,000 Model 3, but it may not matter because that's, you know, that's for investors and economy will change and, you know, demand will determine the price.
I don't always say this about announcements that Elon makes, but the tabless battery is legit from like a science standpoint. Everything is about how their ability to manufacture it. Everything that was said in terms of reducing costs seems to line up with what experts think is possible. But it's one thing for experts to say it's possible. It's another thing to manufacture at scale.
I wonder at what point Tesla becomes a battery company primarily.
I think they already are.
And they just buy from themselves.
Yeah. Well, they said they're still going to be buying from like Panasonic and LG and all the other manufacturers in the short term, just because they are they have so much demand that they need those. But they said like even with buying up all the supply they can get their hands on, they would have a shortage by 2022 in order to meet the car production they need. I don't know. This is not dissimilar to what Apple's doing. This is complete vertical integration from soup to nuts, or what did they say? From cells to cars is what they said. But it is very much the same playbook that Apple has from the chip manufacturer all the way through to the end user product. So from that sense, like if you think about this in an Apple context, you can see the play.
And while they are a car company now, you know, they also sell batteries for the home and there's a huge market for that. So in the same way that like we always say, the iPod Nano helped make the scaling of solid state drives, you know, feasible for iPhone. You know, this all works for PowerCell in the future. All right. We are, we're only about 10 minutes left. So we're going to do a speed round for our next section. We're skipping technology because I feel like we've covered that with the top story and with the talk of documentaries. So we're going to go to pop culture next. Oh, that was my alert that I have to be done in 10 minutes. You get an extra bit of alert. Hope it's not too triggering for those of you who also use Google Calendar. Okay. First bit, a wonderful podcast song exploder. Man, this is the whole thing. Podcasts get turned or Twitter accounts get turned in TV shows, but Song Exploder is getting a TV show on Netflix and they're going to have a Hamilton song coming October 2nd.
This is great. This is great. This is, makes perfect sense. I mean, you put me in a boardroom with a bunch of smarties, I would have said the same thing. I love Song Exploder. It's a wonderful podcast that takes one song and analyzes it, breaks it down to its component parts, talks to the musicians who wrote it, talked about how they made it, what was the thinking, what were the inspirations, what were the different parts. It gives you, it like multiplies your appreciation for any song that's on that podcast by a million. I love it.
I think the thing is, the challenge for them is to make it interesting across all genres of music for people who may not know the songs or maybe not into those genres. And then obviously they're getting much better access with Alicia Keys and Lin-Manuel and, you know, very popular songs, but they run in that same, you know, rock band problem where like, I only like these songs. And so, you know, you try to please everyone. So they have to make it interesting and have some mass appeal. And obviously the producers know that. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm just excited that a podcast that's been around for a long time is getting its due, as opposed to like celebrity coming in to host a podcast, which is how the industry is going.
I mean, there are some great podcasts out there and some great celebrity hosting of podcast shows out there as well.
Honestly, music now is so commoditized. It's like, I think people stopped thinking about the art of engineering a good song like, you know, years ago. I think kids just listen to music and think it fell off a tree somewhere. Like, this is going to be a good show for enhancing people's appreciation for that process, the creative process of song making.
And that creative process has changed because of collaborations and remote collaborations. There was the whole TikTok thread. The best thing to come out of TikTok was the back and forth, people sampling each other, creating interesting beats, and then, you know, creating duets, right? Remotely, completely asynchronously. Has some of the best stuff. All right, MCU news. Got some casting news. Ant-Man 3 has its villain. It's Jonathan Majors cast as Kang.
Holy moly.
What's this mean?
I thought for sure he was going to be a big bad. Is he going to be a smaller bad? Or is this just going to be an intro? This is massive news.
Kang the Conqueror is one of those cosmic, crazy comic book villains. It's like, it's not your traditional superhero villain in the movies.
He's a Thanos. Time traveler who sucks at time traveling, basically.
Yeah. He's a time traveler who like fights younger and older versions of himself. And like, his like, is just always fighting against his destiny of like, of losing. Right. But there's, in the comics canon, it's revealed that he is possibly an ancestor to Reed Richards, also Dr. Doom. Who knows? Time travel gets funky and weird and all sorts of stuff. But the theory is that this may be a way to introduce the larger, you know, Fox acquired licensed movie universe stuff into the MCU. And Ant-Man is already a weird time traveling cosmic quantum realmy. You know, they got the Rick and Morty writer in there for Ant-Man 3. So, you know, it feels very right that they're going to go with Kang potentially as the villain.
Offbeat. When you mess with time, it messes back.
That's true. Don't push back. Jonathan Majors is currently in Lovecraft Country. Amazing, amazing show. You guys should watch it. It's along with The Boys, two favorite shows on television right now. Also, Star Trek Lower Decks.
You can handle The Boys? Man, that show gets me down.
Oh, it's so depressing.
Too much. Grotesque. Stormfront is too much for this current moment in time.
Yeah. Lovecraft Country, while imperfect and definitely some editing and storytelling pacing problems, the last three episodes, extremely strong. Also started off strong. The pilot, so good. Okay, back to MCU news. TV show news. MCU She-Hulk has been cast. It's Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black, as well as Perry Mason most recently. Wonderful casting.
Amazing casting. Amazing casting. She-Hulk's a lawyer, as opposed to He-Hulk, who is a scientist.
Is this canon? Is that true?
It is. She's the cousin to Bruce Banner, and her portrayal has been wide-ranging, we'll say, in the comics. But it's about just like the dual personality of when she's Hulkified, she retains all her intelligence. It's not like the dumbed down Hulk that we get. So it's just the super strength. But we assume they're going to go with a CG portrayal for the Hulk version. And she's just such a versatile actor that I can't wait. Yeah, I think it's great casting. Also in the MCU, we have the trailer for WandaVision still coming out this year. So Black Widow just announced today, pushed back. Eternals pushed back. Shang-Chi pushed back. Movies are not going to be great this year, but we're getting Falcon Winter Soldier and we're getting WandaVision, and the trailer for WandaVision looks like they put that money on the screen.
Woo! Head trippy, weird. No, I have no idea how, like, what the narrative and how they're going to execute it is. The look and their ability to traverse different sort of television universes, it looks incredible.
And I'm television all universes. For...
What's
you
that?
Don't mean like you don't mean like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television, like and Netflix, no. Marvel. No, you mean like the tonal shifts in this, the fact that they go harken back to like a Bewitched styles 60s era, you know, sitcom to the more gritty, you know, the surrealness. Yeah, a lot of people say it's looks akin to Legion, which was another like Fox Marvel show, in terms of the head trippiness of it all. It can't end well, but the appetite for this show is there. We haven't had a new MCU thing since Spider-Man Far From Home.
Yeah. And I'm also all for like a superhero show that isn't about just like beating up bad guys, which is what they've all been. So
yeah, one of my friends said of this trailer, oh, wow, it's a Marvel thing that doesn't immediately look like a Marvel thing. You know, well done.
Yeah. Okay, last bits real quick. I only got 3 minutes left. CBS All Access getting renamed to Paramount Plus. Sure, why not? Still looking forward to all the Star Trek shows. Go watch Lower Decks. Also out today, Console Wars is a new documentary on CBS All Access. I'll watch it. This is like Chicken Soup, like the High Score documentary. You know, probably the same stories you've heard, but... you know, it's something solid to put on while eating dinner. Lego news. We had on Batman Day, a Lego Batwing UCS set. Looks amazing based on the Tim Burton 1989 Batwing
wall
model.
Mountable too.
Wall mountable. Some great minifigs that come with that. You got Boombox Henchman and you got the long tail, the big tuxedo Joker, as well as Batman. And then also in Lego news, a Lego Baby Yoda. Kind of a whole sculptural version that went up for pre-order shipping next month as well. Netflix, yeah, not everything needs to be Lego.
Right. Yeah, so
like, this is one of those like everything. Yeah. Okay. Netflix canceled Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. Won't get a season two. Rather unfortunate there. I think it's one of those things that it's just not enough people watched it or not enough people bought the merchandise for it. And they want it to be a bigger kind of franchise than it ended up being. So the Henson family said they're going to look for new ways to tell that story. So that does it for pop culture this week. We made it to our deadline so I can make my call. We have an outro this week from Great Job. This, I haven't listened to this one, but it's called Jeremy's Disappointment. Let's hear what it says. Sounds like.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
Marvel and Star Wars, the way that they're approaching these forever franchises are different.
I don't know.
It's really fascinating. Like,
one thing at a time, right?
50 years from now.
Let's let JJ have his time in the spotlight. Yeah. I got a good feeling about this film. I'm feeling good about the next one.
It's all trap.
One of the biggest pop culture news items of the year was revealed this week. The title for Episode 8.
Star Wars in Red. The Last Jedi.
And hearing from Rian Johnson and all the other people involved that this is a weird movie, do you keep hearing that too?
Yeah. No, I haven't heard it's a weird movie. I heard it's going to be great.
What did you think of The Last Jedi?
I was not happy with the film.
Wow.
Obviously,
it's on record.
I'm an optimist.
I have a review for that. Great job.
Great job.
All right. I approve.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week. Bye.